Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Mecklenburg County and the city of Charlotte proclaim racism a public health crisis. What that means. The ongoing protests are beginning to have an impact. We talk about what's changing or likely to change as a result. The move of the Republican convention from Charlotte raises questions about broken promises in both directions. And the old Eastland Mall site finally has a future. Here to update us on all of that and more is David Borax and Ann Doss Helms, both with WFAE News. Good morning to both of you, David.
Good morning.
Ann?
Good morning from Belmont.
Yes, good to see you. You're coming through the tunnel this morning. Glenn Berkins is founder and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Welcome back.
Morning, Mike.
And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
We're all on the radio thanks to Zoom. We're also on Facebook Live this morning. This week, Charlotte and many cities around the country experienced the third week of protests as part of the national uproar over police brutality.
The people united will never be divided. The people united will never be divided.
That sound from Monday night's protest organized by Million Youth March of Charlotte and Salisbury. And David, you've been covering these protests in Charlotte ever since the beginning. I know things have been changing at these rallies in terms of size as time goes on. What other changes have you been seeing?
Well, first of all, I just want to note that they're still going on. It hasn't been every night, but, you know, this is an extended period of demonstration here in Charlotte and across the country. And I think that sets it apart from a few years ago when things kind of petered out shortly. And it speaks to how broad this movement really is. But I will say the protests have shrunk in size in the last week or so, but they're still going. And the organization that you mentioned, Million Youth March of Charlotte and Salisbury, has been handling most of the evening protests in Charlotte. And they have been doing themes in recent nights. On Wednesday night, they were remembering the Emmanuel AME Zion killings of 5 years ago. And I was out there on Monday night when they had Vivian Carr along with them. Vivian Carr is the mother of Justin Carr, who's the protester who was shot and killed by another protester during the protest in 2016 here in Charlotte. And, you know, there was an emotional moment on Monday night when protesters were chanting Justin Carr's name and kneeling outside the Omni. And it really, I don't know, there have been so many of these emotional moments. It really captures a sense of how this is this year.
Justin Carr, of course, is the young man who lost his life during the protests over the death of Keith Lamont Scott several years ago here in Charlotte. You spoke with, I think, Mario Black, who was an organizer of Monday's event here. And he said, because people are wondering, how long will this go on? And he told you, as long as people want it to go on. Is that the prevailing viewpoint?
You know, there are people who are ready to go out every night, it seems. And I think in particular, that this group that's organizing these nightly protests is talking about their goal here is to keep this going and to keep this message alive and not let it die out. And, you know, he did say that at some point he expects that this will shift from a nightly protest into maybe more of a push for legislation and changes at the state and national level. And but, you know, we're not seeing it yet. I think there's still an appetite among folks to be out there and to be reminding us all that this is an unbelievable moment of potential change.
Yeah. I think that's the big challenge, isn't it? Because I heard Mark Morial this morning from a national perspective saying, make this a movement, not a moment. Can you sustain this? To David's point, can you take it into legislation and into the political arena and into meaningful changes? You saw particularly those intense first 2 weeks. You saw a lot of changes, policy type things happening. And the question is whether you can sustain that pressure and get more changes to follow.
Yeah. And to be honest, and to be fair, we are starting to see some changes around the edges, both in Charlotte in terms of policing and Minnesota and other places. Legislators are starting to take a timid look at this. So I'm optimistic that we will see some tinkering around the edges. We're not going to eliminate systemic racism overnight or anytime in probably in my lifetime. But I am optimistic that we are starting to see some modest changes around, especially law enforcement.
Yeah. I'm going to try this again. Anne?
Okay. I think that Sheriff Gary McFadden may have infused new life into the protest on the streets, too. I think a lot of us saw yesterday where he gave Charlotte Uprising has been stationed out in front of the jail on the sidewalks doing a jail support project for people who are coming in and out of the jail. And he gave them until 2 o'clock to disperse, and they didn't. So we've all seen now video and photos of people being cuffed and dragged away. I think there were 40 some arrests, which is very high. So just as it felt like things were sort of starting to taper off, you know, there are some troubling images now. And I think the jail support group has support that goes beyond the core Charlotte Uprising people. Mm-hmm. We had a demonstration in Belmont that was very small, very peaceful. The police co-sponsored it, but one of my neighbors was one of the organizers. And that evening, she was loading leftover bottled water and saying, "I'm taking it to the jail support people over there." So I think there's a new variable in this mix.
Those folks have been out in front of the jail for a while. I'm not sure how long. Maybe one of you knows. But what was the reason that Gary McFadden wanted them gone?
He came out and spoke with them earlier in the day yesterday, and he said he wanted them all to leave by 2 o'clock. And he cited, he said that there had been some harassment of jail workers. There were some complaints about, you know, people saying things to folks as they were walking in and out of the jail. There was some complaint about homeless people being in the group. You know, I think, you know, McFadden was trying in this video, which I watched of this moment, to be conciliatory and talk about continuing to work with these folks. But it was an affront to them and a challenge, and they called for support, and folks came out, and they had what they called a sit-in, and that's what prompted the forcible removals yesterday afternoon.
But to be clear, no tear gas, no other projectiles were used. It was all one-on-one. And they did, as I understand it, the people out there protesting put a line of bicycles between them and the police as kind of a barricade, so to speak. Didn't work, but nonetheless. How many people were arrested?
I believe 43.
Wow.
And I haven't seen a breakdown of the charges, but it was very clear. And I can't believe that the sheriff or anybody thought that Uprising would say, "Okay, you want us gone by 2 o'clock? We'll see you." You know, they had to have known there was going to be resistance. And at least as of last night, I was watching a live stream that looked like they just moved across the street. There were people yelling out Bleep 12, which is a reference to Adam 12, the police. It's you know, it's a variation on F the police. So yeah, there is that kind of yelling going on. I don't know what we're going to see as this, you know, as Juneteenth now plays out.
Right. So are these protests in the last week, are they in just little pockets of people of 20 or 30, or are they larger groups of people? Or is there, how do people know that these things are going to take place night after night?
So this is all being organized over social media, and there are a couple different accounts you could follow in Charlotte if you wanted to keep up with the flyers and announcements of the latest events. And sometimes it's like 6 o'clock at night. There's a notice put out, "We're going to meet at such and such a place, and we're going to do this." But I also should note that, you know, we talked about the Million Youth March that's organizing many of these nightly protests in Charlotte. There are many other groups in Charlotte that have held different events as well. I mean, City Council Member Malcolm Graham organized one, Black Men March, that was also to commemorate the Emmanuel Zion Church killings. And Charlotte Uprising has been active. And these groups all have different themes and agendas that they're pursuing. And, you know, it is not one unified movement. For example, Charlotte Uprising, they are focused much more on criminal justice reform and police brutality. And that's one of the reasons why I did a story recently about how they have asked police not to join in. And they've actually had confrontations with police over this. You know, why would we invite you to join our rally or our march if you are exactly what we're protesting against? So there are different, you know, different agendas going on here. And I think that it's important to remember that. And, you know, there's the broader theme of racial injustice, but then there are other things.
And it seems that these are having an effect here and around the country, maybe not to the degree that the protesters would like to see, and maybe not as quickly as protesters would like to see. And I guess we'll have to wait for a while to see what the true impact of some of the changes that they are affecting here. But the impact is being felt from Washington to Charlotte to Raleigh. The Mecklenburg County Commission and the City Council this week, in separate actions, declared racism to be a public health crisis. This has happened in more than 20 cities and counties and in three states around the country. The Mecklenburg County Commission approved their proclamation on Tuesday night, and Commissioner Mark Jarrell introduced the resolution.
The proclamation sends a signal to the community to let them know that we understand the impacts that racism has had on certain segments of our population. It lets them know that we are committed to changing outcomes.
And he also said we have to put some teeth behind it, but it gives us the framework and the backdrop to work off of. He isn't alone among commissioners in that sentiment. Susan Rodriguez McDowell reiterated that comment. So what does the county commission's proclamation do?
Well, it doesn't do anything in terms of laying out a plan or allocating money. It's just a proclamation, but it is an important symbol. The medical community has recognized for a long time that racism and the effects of racism on Black Americans is detrimental to their health. And when we talk about racism, we're talking about institutional and structural things. Everything from highways that tend to cut through Black communities, poor air quality, industrial plants that tend to be located in Black and poor communities, all the way to things like stress and anxiety, which are silent killers. And the medical community has known for a long time, and in fact talks about the fact that these things are having a detrimental effect on the health of Black people in America, leading to other chronic diseases, high blood pressure, diabetes, stroke, you name it. So while this proclamation did not have teeth, I think it was an important recognition. And one more thing that I would add, Mike, this county commission has been very aggressive, or at least more aggressive than some in the past, about telling our county manager, we want actual dollars in the county budget to address racial disparities, whether it's housing or early childhood education, trying to get more parks and greenways in Black and poor communities. So they have made some tentative moves.
The county commission proclamation is worded this way. It says racism, it says many things, but among them, racism unfairly disadvantages Black and brown individuals and communities while unfairly giving advantages to other individuals and communities. How does the city's proclamation differ? Anybody know? And does the city's proclamation
similar.
Have any teeth? Glenn?
You know, let me
show
this.
They are very similar in wording. There's not a lot of difference. I don't believe the city's has any teeth either. I think it's simply a proclamation.
You know, a proclamation is not necessarily intended to have teeth. I think we should think of this as a call to action. There really is a nationwide call to action right now, and a call to reframe the way we think about this. I mean, there's been similar calls in the past decade or so to discuss firearms as a public health crisis as well. And so we're really being asked to look at all kinds of policies in a new way here.
David Borax is with WFAE News, as is Ann Doss Helms. Glenn Berkins is here from Q City Metro, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. We're coming back to talk about more of the things surrounding the protest, but also many other things have gone on this weekend. We'll talk about those too. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Eric Spanberg joins us from the Charlotte Business Journal, along with Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News. David Borax also with us, and Glenn Birkins, founder publisher of QCityMetro.com. We had both Mecklenburg County Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden and CMPD Chief Kerr Putney on the program this past week. And Putney said that he sees in his department areas for improvement. He was talking specifically about what happened on June 2nd. That was the night that police corralled peaceful protesters into a one-block area, I think, of 4th Street, and then used tear gas on them. But he promised to announce some changes on sometime this coming week. Any information about what those changes might be in light of what happened that night? It's okay. He's keeping it pretty close to the vest. He wouldn't give it up here on this program either. There have been suggestions. This whole defund the police movement around the country, in most cases, is not about defunding the police or abolishing the police, although that is happening in some areas. It's about taking some of the money that police have and shifting it to other support agencies, and to take some of the things that police do and shift that to other more applicable agencies, people who are better suited to handle things like domestic disputes and traffic violations, and patrolling the schools, the use of school resource officers. The constant presence of police in the schools is now coming under question. What are they considering in North Carolina, Ann?
I don't know that there's anything formal out there yet, but it's always been a background discussion, but the push more recently, especially here in Charlotte, has been toward more officers because of mass shootings elsewhere, because of a fatal shooting at Butler High. You know, they have added officers, they have added a gun sniffing dog, a drug sniffing dog, they've added random searches at high schools. So that kind of the safety aspect has overridden the aspect of, do we really need armed police officers who can make arrests in every middle and high school, which CMS does right now. And I have heard several board members say, we are at least willing to rethink that. And we are at some point going to have that discussion, maybe not right away, given, you know, the whole reopening schools thing that cannot be delayed. But, and there have been students out there at some of these protests saying, you know, it's not good that there are things like fights, like small marijuana possessions, that could be handled better without having a police officer right there. That the safety, you don't get that much more safety, but you get a feeling that can be especially hostile to students of color that may feel just fine to white students who are more used to seeing police as protectors.
Allegations of racism have led to the suspension this week of Audrey Kell High School's principal, David Switzer, and that has ignited a public debate. As of Monday, and this is early in the week, so the number of people here may be highly inaccurate, 9,000 people had signed dueling online petitions, one in favor, one against, of the principal. Kira McCray is a black graduate of Audrey Kell, told WBTV that she was in favor of removing Switzer.
It's time for a change in leadership, honestly. I think that leadership is one you look at in these situations when you have instances of racial bias and racial slurs being thrown at students and students being called ghetto.
But Switzer has support from some Audrey Kell parents who rallied outside the school, who also spoke with WBTV.
I'm just not happy with how he's been vilified because, of all people, he didn't deserve it.
He is fair and just to everybody. It doesn't matter the color of your skin. It doesn't matter. He's always there to support every single kid.
So, Ann, what is this about?
Well, this goes back several years. There have been definitely some instances of white Audrey Kell students using racial slurs, and there are some concerns about whether David Switzer reacted strongly enough to that. It's always difficult to get information about what actual disciplinary actions were taken against individuals because that's confidential. There was then an instance where apparently in a staff meeting, he was talking about some kind of racial sensitivity training. And apparently what he was trying to say was, this is not just about making people of color happy, that this is important for all of us, but what he said apparently was colored people. And then he held a follow-up meeting to apologize to staff. Someone recorded that and gave that recording to the Observer. So there's that. There was then, but this whole rock thing is the national context and this defacing of the rock. David Switzer gave some students permission to paint the school rock with Black Lives Matter slogans. Someone may or may not have even been a student, but somebody then came by and defaced that with some racist slogans. There was then a big gathering to repaint the rock. And it was sort of in the context of all of that and this whole push to really hold people accountable for racism that some people talked to Annie Mott, The Observer. They were not named in the article, but current and former students who said he just hasn't done enough. I mean, they're not saying that he's a, you know, somebody who's out there using the N-word, but there's a feeling that he has to be held accountable. And then there's a counter feeling of people saying, but wait, he's trying really hard to counteract this.
Yeah, you reported that after speaking with some people at the school, that he's actively working to, some people say that he's actively working toward creating an environment that is more culturally accepting, and that in recent years when white students there shouted racial slurs or posted them on social media, he responded, Switzer responded by trying to educate students and faculty about racism. So how do you square that with the allegations that he's facing?
Well, I think it is really a difference that you often see in this kind of situation where white people tend to focus very much on the individual. And so we are seeing large numbers. I think it's, as of this morning, there were almost 6,900 people who had signed the petition to keep him. I don't know that they're all white, but a lot of the most vocal people have been white, and they've been saying, he's trying, he might make some mistakes, but he's one of the good guys. And but then there's the focus on the collective. And I think we've seen this throughout society that there's been a lot of talk about trying to do the right thing, but the right thing doesn't happen. Right. So when do we start holding people accountable? And I think Glenn had something to say.
Yeah.
Yes, I think we have to be, I think we have to be careful here. A lot of the allegations that have been leveled against him, as Anne correctly pointed out, are not things that are blatantly racist. Fortunately, CMS is investigating. We don't know when that investigation will be completed, but I'm hoping that it will be thorough, and I'm hoping that to some degree it will be made public. I don't know what the policy is on that. What we're hearing about this principal, depending on who's talking, in some cases, it's just so diametrically opposed. He's been painted as someone who is trying to make the school more tolerant. He's been painted as someone who is not moving fast enough, and in fact, in some ways, who may have actually contributed. So I'm really hoping that CMS will be able to let the public know the results of this, of its findings.
And Key City Metro, Glenn, reported that he, some say he directly contributed to a culture of intolerance at the school, using crude language, berating students, failing to seriously discipline those who made racial comments. How can these two different descriptions be of the same man?
I don't know. I don't know this principal. I've never met him. I've talked to people who do know him, and I've heard, as you just pointed out, I've heard competing narratives. Yeah. And all of his defenders are not white. I've heard black people who say he is essentially a good person.
Do we know, Anne, who defaced that rock?
No.
Was it students? We don't know.
We don't know. It's way out front. The cameras are on the building. There are there's a parking lot and a large lawn with trees. You'd have to try pretty hard to get caught on camera. So I'm guessing they don't have anybody on camera doing that. There were two other nearby middle schools that had similar defacement. There was then a school in Union County. So this could be students. It could be people in the community who have a political viewpoint. Things like Black Lives Matter were painted over with Blue Lives Matter. So this is part of that whole climate of tension. And I was telling you all before, there was a Facebook post that to me just really drove home how difficult this is. And this was from an African-American mother of an Ardwick Hill student who said, I've lived in Ballantyne for 20 years. I love this community. I have awesome and wonderful friends. I've been part of fundraising and group activities. But now I'm looking at my friends' pages and posts, and I'm hearing their silence and their support. It said, It is clear how you feel. My life doesn't matter. My kids' lives don't matter, or at least don't matter as much as you staying comfortable in your privilege. That's a really tough thing. If you are somebody who believes that David Switzer is a good guy, but if you start to realize that potentially you're rallying to his defense is telling some of the families of color that you're not hearing them, this is why we have a hard time with race.
There's a much bigger expectation these days of change. I mean, we're in a different time right now. And if keeping somebody in a position, even though they might be on the right track, sends a signal about keeping the status quo, that is not satisfactory to a lot of people.
But the problem there, it seems to me, is much broader than the principal. If he's having to have race conversations about language being used at football games and racial slurs being thrown back and forth and posting them online, that speaks to a problem that is infinitely larger than him and infinitely larger than Ardrey Kell. It speaks to society as a whole. Is this something that's happening everywhere? Why is it happening at Ardrey Kell?
I am so glad you brought that point up, Mike, because we talk about schools being a reflection of the communities. And when we hear that, we often are talking about some of the problems that exist in poor schools and in schools that are predominantly Black. But it's true in reverse as well. Whatever problems we're seeing in our schools, they are reflections of the communities from which these students are coming. And as you pointed out, this is not an Ardrey Kell issue. This is not a CMS issue. This is not a North Carolina issue. We see these kinds of things happening all over, not just in high schools, but in colleges. At this point, we are a nation that is just deeply divided on this issue of race. It continues to be the fault line more than anything else that separates America.
But it's not just schools. It's also in businesses as well. I mean, we had a case over the past couple of weeks where people are calling for a boycott of CPI Security, which is based in Charlotte, over remarks that their CEO there said, made. And it's the same kind of thing. People's expectations are higher now, and they're holding everybody accountable.
It's also why you're seeing the, I guess, Quaker Oats Company removing Aunt Jemima and perhaps Uncle Ben and other products from the shelves in the very near future as they find a way to change the branding on those products because they have used for years racial symbols. But the fact that we're talking about Ardrey Kell and the fact that we're saying these things aren't just the principal, if in fact he's at all to blame, it's students and others at football games yelling racial slurs. Does that not fall right into the hands of protesters around the country saying, we have a problem? There it is, right there, clearly.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, what more? Yeah, all these things that we just went through are such obvious examples of the racism and the schism that Glenn just mentioned. I mean, the fact that we still even had Aunt Jemima to have to take off of the pancake syrup boxes, the syrup bottles and the pancake boxes, the fact that we still have all these Confederate monuments that are slowly beginning to come down, it just shows you how, in many ways, what a glacial pace, sort of racial reconciliation has occurred at. I mean, it's just incredible when you think that we are in 2020 and we're talking about these things still existing.
And that's where we're going next, because there's also the question of these statues and these monuments of the Confederacy and the Confederate war heroes. Jefferson Davis was toppled this week in the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia. NASCAR has banned Confederate flags, and now there are calls for removing Confederate heroes' names from buildings, and they're suddenly being heated, because among the calls is one to change the name of Vance High School. For those who don't know, who was Zebulon Vance, Ann?
He was a governor, and this was not named, back in the early 1900s. This was the 1990s, and they built the Governor's Village complex near UNC Charlotte, and they picked four governors to name schools after, and one of them was Zebulon Vance, who was a slave owner. He was a Confederate officer. He was governor in the early 1860s during the Confederacy. Then was elected again in 1876, and apparently was really big on education after that. And I was in Charlotte, but not covering education at that time. I don't think there was a lot of debate over choosing that name. I think we're all kind of trying to track back and say, what were they thinking then? But
1997. I mean, what are we talking about?
Yeah. And I think, again, this speaks to the ability that white America has had to kind of compartmentalize and put a little asterisk and say, okay, that whole slave thing, that whole, you know, devaluing the lives and dignity of Black people, we don't approve of that, but he was really good on education. He was apparently a very popular guy among white people. So they're now looking back and saying, and I have heard from in some way, shape or form, every school board member, they're saying this is a low hanging fruit, but there's no question on Tuesday, we are going to relaunch. We're going to launch the renaming. And then we're going to start to look at the names of other schools, because a lot of CMS schools are named after people, everything.
Where did that move come from to take his name off that building? Where did that move come from? Obviously the school board, but where?
I am not actually sure. It's been floating for a while. Ruby Jones, who represents that area, said, my community has been there for a while in terms of wanting to get rid of this, but I have never heard that come up explicitly before.
Has there been any reaction advance about the possible change?
No, and they're saying they are going to involve the community, because there are now, you know, more than 20 years worth of graduates of Vance High School who have, you know, what, and somebody I was talking to said, oh, I just always thought of it as Vance High School. I never thought of it as Zebulon Vance, an actual figure. So I don't know. There may be some pushback.
And
it is now a majority non-white school. I think it's like 2% white, majority Black, a large Hispanic population.
And UNC Chapel Hill trustees have listed a 16-year moratorium on renaming campus buildings on that campus. It was put in place in 2015 after it was decided to change the name of a classroom building named for William Saunders, who was reputedly a Ku Klux Klan leader. And at the time, the board said the moratorium would give them time to, quote, develop new education initiatives and evaluate their effectiveness. I don't know what that has to do with building names, but this week, Board Chair Richard Stephen says it's time to do it. So what will that mean, and how many campus buildings are going to be affected by this?
I think was it the Daily Tar Heel reported there were something like 30 buildings on campus that had links to slavery or supremacists
white supremacy, I should say.
So that's obviously a lot of work ahead. I mean, somehow that whole thing slipped past me, that there was a 16-year moratorium. That's insane. It seems to be able to figure out whether a program is working or not. But all of these things go back to the fact that, you know, these are not secrets, but they are things that have been shoved under the carpet for, you know.
And with that, we must stop because your connection just burped. So we'll stop right now. We'll come back with more in about 90 seconds. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our local news roundup here every Friday. David Borax from WFAE News is with us, along with Glenn Birkins, founder publisher of QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Ann Doss Helms, also from WFAE. We talked about monuments and building name changes as a result of these protests that have been going on for 3 weeks around the country. In Charleston, South Carolina, the birth of the Confederacy, they have decided to remove the statue of slavery advocate John C. Calhoun from a downtown square. Clearly, hell has frozen over. This is the fifth anniversary of the Mother Emanuel shootings. That's when that took place. On that day, they made that announcement. Name changes for buildings on the campuses of USC and Clemson University are also being considered. But both houses of the state, this requires a vote of the state legislature, both houses of which are controlled by Republicans, and the leader of the House has said he would never consider a change like that. What is the likelihood that this will happen in South Carolina to any great degree?
I think there, maybe this is naive, but I think there is some momentum to make these changes. You know, you mentioned South Carolina, the University of South Carolina and Clemson University. One of the things really interesting is you had a lot of the high profile former football players who have come out publicly and demanded this. I think at Clemson, they've already made the decision to remove John Calhoun's name from the Honors College, for example. Hmm. You're seeing some things that have not happened. Of course, you mentioned a couple of times, Mike, the fifth anniversary of the tragedy at Mother Emanuel. And a lot of people at the time said just how god-awful not only obviously the whole event was, but that it took that to remove the Confederate flag from the Capitol grounds. And the policy that you're talking about was part of that deal to remove the Confederate flag. But I think there might be enough public pressure to perhaps push the legislators to maybe cede some ground on some of these issues, because I don't think it's something that's going to be a 1 or 2 day story. I think there's more momentum here.
Glenn.
If you're Black in America, you have to see this as a good thing. These are affronts to the dignity of Black Americans. They are affronts to a balanced history of our country and the contributions and the suffering that African Americans have endured. But while we take down statues and rename buildings, we must not forget that these, at the end of the day, are symbols. You know, you talked, Mike, about hell freezing over. I will say hell is frozen over when we have representation in corporate boardrooms, when we have representations in corporate America. Those are the things in employment, in lending, in housing, in education. Those are the real issues that will make this country truly great. Taking down monuments, that's a good thing, but it does not address the systemic problems that Black people face every day. We've
been talking about this for years, Glenn, as you well know, but now it's actually happening. Does that say that people are finally in a position to want to listen?
Well, like I said, I think we have to celebrate that, yes, but it can't end there. I won't say it's easy, but it's a lot easier to take down a statue than it is to fix some of the other systemic problems that truly bring about inequity and discrimination and poor health outcomes and poor educational outcomes. These are the easy things we can do, and I'm glad we're doing them.
I was going to say, but Glenn, I completely agree with you, but they have not been easy for us to do. As sad as that is to say, they have not been easy for us to do. So I do think it matters. Symbols matter. But to your point, absolutely. The health, the economic equity, the educational equity, those are the things that are really difficult. I thought one of the most interesting things in the past couple of weeks was Mayor Vi Lyles coming out and addressing the corporate community in Charlotte and saying, look, you have to stop going to the same elite colleges over and over when you hire. You need to look at HBCUs. You need to look at state schools. You need to look at community colleges. If Vi Lyles or anyone else or a collective of people can get movement in areas like that, that's when you really start to make some societal changes.
The Black unemployment rate. No, go ahead, Ann.
I think we do have to be aware that history tells us that power gives up the smallest possible concession. And there will be people who figure we have to do something now. If we give up a monument rather than giving up actual power and privilege, then we can say that's done. Move on.
Is that what's happening in Gaston County, where the I think one Gaston County commissioner, Ronnie Worley, has proposed that the Confederate statue outside the courthouse come down? He says this monument has sat on Gaston County's mantle long enough.
Yeah, and I've done jury duty there. I live in Gaston County. It's a very conservative county, and you walk up and there's this huge towering obelisk with a Confederate soldier on top of it. I've covered gatherings of the Sons of Confederate Veterans there. The fact that one commissioner is saying it's time to move it is a change for this county, but it doesn't even mean that that obelisk will move. But it is a sign that this is reaching beyond the urban areas.
Before we move on, the Southeastern Conference said unless Mississippi removes the Confederate emblem from its state flag, the conference will not hold any championship events in the state of Mississippi. That's where all this is heading, I suppose. Sports tend to change things and change them quickly.
Can I just jump in here real quick? One more thing to add to the list of changes that Glenn is talking about is, and Ann, you mentioned the word history. I mean, there are so many aspects of our American history that we are not taught. Today is Juneteenth. How many people know what that is? It's something that for a lot of people was never taught in school. There was a piece on NPR this morning about a massacre in Tulsa that I have to say I never heard about. It was a massacre of African-Americans by white people. And there are so many things like that that have not been included in our history. And yet the symbols that we have still standing all over the place are another version of our history that is, controlled in a different way. And I think we've got to go as deep as we can on this and include it in our curriculums.
Okay. Wilmington, right here in North Carolina. Go ahead, Mike.
We're moving on. We have to move on. I'm sorry. We have a lot of stuff to cover here. This was the week that Charlotte City Council finally voted on Eastland Mall rezoning. The vote was unanimous. Matt Newton represents that area on City Council.
This has been a collaborative effort for almost a decade now, and it's really encouraging to see where we are.
What will this rezoning bring to that area?
So this rezoning was put forward by the city and Crossland Southeast, the developer that between the two of them, they own the 70-acre site out there. Remember, the mall was one of the first big malls in North Carolina, and it was torn down in 2013, and it's been vacant, and the city has been trying to figure out what to do with it ever since then. The rezoning divides the 70 acres into three pieces. One is mainly residential. One is kind of a mix of residential and businesses, kind of neighborhood businesses. And the third is reserved for some kind of active use. And we all know that the city is in negotiations with David Tepper, the owner of the Panthers, about putting a practice facility and headquarters for the new MLS team there. The city is hoping that this development will attract some neighborhood businesses that are already in the area to expand into another place there. I think many of the neighbors support this. It's still got a long way to go. There still needs to be a big agreement on that, and we'll see what happens in the coming months.
So it's over 1,000 homes, restaurants, offices, a 2-acre public park, plus MLS facilities, and that's the cornerstone of it all. Are you saying that that's not decided? I mean, they've rezoned it. When will work begin?
Oh, it's decided what's going there. I think the next there's still all these, like a development agreement and that sort of thing. But Eric, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, David. I mean, this is just the first step. And then you have to have all those development agreements. And not least, you have to figure out the $110 million between city money that will go to the MLS project. So there's still a lot of pieces that have to be put together here.
So the number of COVID-19 cases in North Carolina continues to rise. We're one of the hot spots in the country. Nearly 50,000 people in the state have tested positive since March 3rd. It isn't known yet how many of those cases are still active, but the state posted nearly 1,200 deaths on Thursday, nearly 900 people in the hospital. And this has renewed the debate about face masks. Under phase two, fewer people are staying home. Social distancing appears to be on the decline. So some Mecklenburg County officials want to mandate people wearing face masks in public. Susan Rodriguez McDowell, Mecklenburg County Commissioner, wants to see that happen as a way to ensure that we don't have a return to stricter restrictions.
Wearing masks equals not having to turn backwards. And so for the folks who are very cavalier and think, nothing's going to happen to me, I don't need to wear a mask, if folks could realize that they're shooting themselves in the foot.
And Governor Cooper held a press conference again yesterday. He also brought up the subject of masks and said the state is carefully examining a statewide requirement for face masks, but no decision has yet been made.
If you're going to make a law, you have to be careful about what you're doing, you have to be specific, and you have to have it based on your best evidence. So you just can't snap your finger and say, hey, it's a rule, everybody do it. It's got to be something that's well thought through and something that will be effective with the least intrusion that we can have on people. So that's the kind of things that you think about. You also are going to get better results too when you can convince the public, heart and soul, that this is a good thing to do.
This mystifies me. I swear to God, this mystifies me. Every health professional in the world says wear a face mask. Public health officials, their jobs are to protect public health. We mandate motorcycle helmets. We mandate bicycle helmets. We mandate seatbelts. We can't wear a face mask. They can't mandate a face mask to protect public health.
Well, I think one of the things, Mike, that's a real problem. I mean, there are many problems here and many complications, but One of the biggest
Eric, what are the complications?
Oh, well, I'll give you a couple right here. Just give me a second. One is that when this started, remember, there was a lot of public there were a lot of public declarations that a mask would not make a difference, that a face covering would not make a difference. I think that really sank in with people and they just clutched onto that. And then moving forward to where we are now, the problem from a political and policy standpoint is that enforcing this is all but impossible. And the last part I want to emphasize is that whether you're talking about the masks or reimposing stay-at-home orders, everybody, whether they are in politics or healthcare or anything else, knows we're not going back. The social and political will is not there for people to go back to the stay-at-home order. And so that makes it extremely difficult to convince people to wear masks if they've made up their minds that they're not going to listen to scientific evidence.
We're 7 days away from phase three. Is there political will for going to phase three?
I would expect next week there'll probably be a couple of big announcements. I would not be surprised if Governor Cooper decided to do a statewide mask requirement. They've done it in California and other places. They've done it in some places like Raleigh in North Carolina already. And number two, you know, with the numbers going the way they're going, I think there's some pressure on public health officials to maybe take a pause in the reopening. And it's going to be unpopular, but you know, the numbers, I've been watching hospitalizations pretty closely for the past couple of months, and they are more than double what they were in April. And I'm not saying we're all going to die, but, you know, it is a proxy for how the virus is spreading, and it's still with us.
And the number of cases in Gaston County has increased 312% in just the last 2 weeks. And County Commission Chair Tracy Philbeck in Gaston County called the rise expected and blamed it on Governor Cooper's restrictions. Philbeck wants them loosened. If under the governor's tightened restrictions, the numbers are rising, how would loosening help?
Wait,
I think that's just a sign of what Eric said, that this is very political. We have a county commission chairman who has really pushed everybody to just get out there and go back to business as normal. And he's still going to put the blame
on
the
sentient
governor.
What sentient being believes that science and a virus is political?
Unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there who believe that.
All right. The Charlotte Host Committee for the Republican National Convention lashed out at GOP officials this week for what they called broken promises. To what are they referring? The disappearance of the convention?
Well, Mike, you've threaded these two subjects nicely, because this is a political fight over public health policy. I mean, that's what it is, led by the president, who demanded a guarantee that he could have a full capacity arena. And we saw what happened. So now we're getting into the legal maneuverings and machinations over contracts. And there are a ton of them, starting with the local host committee had the contract, of course, with the Spectrum Center for $5.5 million. That's just one example of the many contracts that are going to have to be unwound. And it seems all but impossible that that can all be negotiated without at least some feuding, fighting, and perhaps a trip or two to the courthouse.
Well, my question there is, under the circumstances, given the fact that we didn't cancel this for political reasons, we just said you can have your convention, you just can't fill the arena, and they decided that that's not what they wanted to do, but it's all over COVID-19. So would it be wise for either side of this to engage in lawsuits with the other?
Well, I mean, I don't know that we're going to start with wisdom when we talk about lawsuits and people mad at each other. So I'll just leave
it's always
that.
Wise for lawyers to file lawsuits.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So Gibby Harris, our Mecklenburg County Health Director, will join us on this program on Wednesday of next week to talk about face masks. That may be, and other things, COVID-19 related. So maybe that'll be one of the announcements next week, as we are 2 days away from phase three opening. I want to thank Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, and Doss Helms and David Borax from WFAE News, and Glenn Birkins, founder publisher of Q-City Metro, for the hour. Thanks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.